these guys were scrappy. They were brilliant. They, as I said, educated themselves. They were incredibly cultured. And they just did what it took to survive in a world that really didn't want them to.
That's Christina Baker Klein, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Ahead, we'll discuss her historical novel about the sisters who, in 1843, married Chang and Ang Bunker, the world-famous conjoined twins from Siam. Christina Baker Klein is the number one New York Times bestselling author of 10 novels, including The Exiles, Orphan Train, and A Piece of the World. She joins us to talk about her latest work of historical fiction, The Foursome. Christina, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I understand you have a personal connection to this story. Tell us about that.
Yes. So my mother's family is related to the two women at the center of this story, Sarah and Adelaide Yates. Sarah and Adelaide's father and my ancestor were brothers. So my mother always said they were her great-great-aunts, distant cousins, perhaps, of mine. So I'm not related to Chang and Ang Bunker. However, on tour, I've just finished a month-long tour around the country, and I met maybe a dozen relatives, people who are descended from Chang and Ang, as well as from the sisters. And they have a reunion every year in Mount Airy, North Carolina, which is where the brothers ended up, Chang and Ang. And also where, by the way, Andy Griffith, where the show is set, Mayberry. And they have a reunion that is both Bunkers and Yates. Yates is the sister's side. So yes, that is my relationship to them.
Well, for those who may not be familiar with Chang and Ang, tell us about them.
Chang and Ang were among the most famous men in the world when they were alive. And actually for many years afterwards, I don't know if you remember, but they were in the Guinness Book of World Records. People heard about them from that, from Time Life magazine, all kinds of sources. What I found on tour is that I sort of assume that most people still have heard of them, but the younger generation may not have. They were conjoined. They were discovered by a British merchant in their tiny fishing village in Siam, which is now Thailand. And he saw them swimming and told a friend that he had just discovered a two-headed hydra and that he thought he could make a fortune from it. He spent years trying to convince their mother to let him take them on tour, and he paid her a hefty sum of money to do so, and they never saw her again. And they ended up in America. They ended up all over Europe, but they ended up settling in America. They were in New York for a while. They traveled all over the country, all over Cuba, South America, all over Europe. And eventually, a doctor invited them to visit his farm in northwestern North Carolina. They fell in love with the region. It reminded them of Siam, they said. And they ended up settling there. And they told the press that all they needed at that point were wives and children, which was, of course, scandalous. But that is, in fact, what happened. They ended up meeting Sarah and Adelaide Yates, and they had 21 children. One had 10 children and one had 11.
Now, these conjoined twins were very famous, but you're not telling the story from their perspective. You're telling it from the perspective of one of the sisters, Sarah. Why did you decide to do that, and in first person for Sarah?
Right. So Chang and Ang have been written about quite extensively, and there have been a number of novels even written about them, a number of nonfiction books, some terrific biographies, including Inseparable, which came out a few years ago. I was most fascinated. I mean, they're larger-than-life exploits, meaning how they got around, how they made a fortune and lost a fortune and gained a fortune again. All of that has been documented. But what hasn't really been explored is what it was like. These are the only conjoined twins in history known to have had children. And what was it like to be in part of that world with them? What was it like to navigate two separate humans who were joined together as a husband and, you know, a brother-in-law, And then to have such an intimate relationship with your own sister as well. The four of them for a while lived in the same house. Eventually they had houses, ended up living a mile apart. The brothers had this kind of pact with each other, this idea, they called it alternate mastery, where when one was in the home of the other, he was entirely passive. He was supposed to be seen and not heard. He was supposed to keep his opinions, his judgments to himself and really not speak. The brothers were quite opinionated, so this didn't always work well, perfectly, but that was the idea. And yet, of course, they had to navigate each other all the time. They tried to be separated many times. They tried to have an operation, but eventually the doctors all backed down because it would have actually been quite a scandal to murder the Siamese twins by trying to separate them. And in fact, in their autopsy, it was sort of proven that they probably wouldn't have been separated in their lifetime without killing one or both of them. So it was all very complicated. And yet we don't know much about what it was like to navigate that on a domestic basis. And I think the fact that convinced me ultimately to write this story from one of the sisters' perspectives was that I was hammering out a timeline of their, what it was like, what the years were like. And I realized that in 1 year, 1865, there were so many calamitous things that happened in the lives of the families. For Sarah, the woman I wrote about, two children died that year. One, her favorite daughter in her early 20s. One, a baby in a very tragic way. She became pregnant and gave birth. The Civil War ended. They lost their fortune. They lost all their workers. The brothers went back on tour together. She had another son who fought in the war and was presumed dead for some months. All of this in 1865. Eventually, she was left with all the children on her own on this homestead. Her husband was gone to make money. She had no help, and she had just lost two children and had an infant. So when I figured out that all of that had happened in the same year and that this woman was having to deal with all of that, and that that had never been written about in any of the biographies I'd come across, I understood that there was a story there that was really worth telling.
And this is a work of historical fiction. So how do you balance the fact with the fiction you need to drive the story?
As much as possible, I stuck to the historical record. My father was a historian. He wrote a dozen books. I never thought I had anything in common with him. He's an academic. I'm a novelist. No one in my family had ever written fiction. But as I began writing books set in the past, the first one I really did that with was a novel called Orphan Train, which is about the 250,000 children sent on trains, mostly to the Midwest, over a 75-year period, roughly. There are now 4 million descendants of those people, but no one had ever written a big novel about it. And I realized then that I felt I had a responsibility to try to be as honest as I could or as factually based as I could, because so many people were coming to that story through my novel for the first time. That's how I've sort of operated ever since. If there is a fact, I'd like to use it. But with that said, there are disputed facts, of course, as there always is when you look into history, and especially little known history about the poor, the dispossessed, and women, because many times there aren't records or aren't good records. And there were also some aspects of the story that I wanted to explore more fully, and so I needed to invent a character to help me do that. So, for example, in this novel, there's a character, Aunt Joan, who is sort of an outsider, and her perspective helps bring some clarity to my central character, Sarah, because everyone in her world that she trusted was sort of telling her the same story, which is, the Confederates are, it's a war of Northern aggression. The Confederates are on the right side of history and all of that. And I needed someone who was an outside point of view. Furthermore, my family is Southern on both sides. And on both sides of my family, there is a kind of Aunt Joan character. There is a person who was not quite buying the status quo, the family legend or story about how things were supposed to be. So I wanted a character like that. And then there are some things that in the record that are murky, and I wanted to go at them and explore them head on. What it was like to be a landowner in the South, what it was like for Grace, who was a real person. Grace is an enslaved person who grew up alongside Sarah in real life and then ended up coming back after she was emancipated and living with Sarah for the rest of her life. I wanted to really explore those stories, and they're not the facts of them are not well known. So yes, it's a novel. And because it's from Sarah's perspective as well, and there's not much of a record about what Sarah really truly thought and felt, all of that is fictional. But the facts, as much as I could stick to them, are true.
Let's talk a bit more about the sisters and why they decided to become the wives of the twins. Because as you mentioned, it was scandalous, the thought of these conjoined twins having wives. And yet here were sisters that decided, we will deal with that in society's expectations. We're going to do this regardless of the pressures that people might be putting on us.
It would even be shocking today. It's not just that it was shocking then, but when you think about the community they lived in, small, conservative, rural, Southern, and let's face it, racist community that was dependent on slavery for its success at the time. And it's almost impossible to fathom how this could have happened. These men were Asian. No one had ever seen an Asian person in that neck of the woods. They had educated themselves. They were autodidacts. They had a huge library like yours. I'm looking at your library behind you. They went into a community of people who weren't big readers, if they were readers. And in fact, in many households, a Bible was the only book on the shelves. These guys had an entire library of books they read in English. And they, mind you, had not even learned to read until they were 17, read or read English. They learned English when they were 17. They spoke perfect English. They were brilliant. They were cultured. They had traveled the world. They had had dinners with princes and, you know, dukes and duchesses and government leaders. They were erudite. They imported their china and linens from Paris and London. It was a whole culture clash in so many ways, and they were conjoined. How in the world would these women, they were young, 19 and 20, the brothers were a decade older, more than a decade older. How in the world would they end up with these men? So all of that fascinated me. And I knew that they were glamorous, the men. There's a phenomenon at the time of penny papers, which were essentially broadsides, tabloids that were in every community. They were brought by stagecoach every fortnight to these small towns and areas so that people could gossip about kings and queens and presidents and celebrities. And these men, Chang and Eng, were in those papers every week. They were quite colorful. They were funny. They were smart. They had romantic exploits around the world. And so the girls would have heard of them. The women would have heard of them already from those. But also there was scandal in their own family. In my novel, the scandals in real life involved their brother Alston. And in fact, 2 years before they married Chang and Eng, there were legal battles. There was adultery. There were children born out of wedlock. There was all this stuff going on in their family. I have no evidence that it directly involved Sarah and Adelaide, but for the purposes of my novel, I wanted to make it sort of close to the bone for them. And God knows it could have, because that happened all the time, that kind of thing. But I think that it might have been a combination of their own prospects being limited for whatever reasons, and the kind of glamour of these outsiders who also were very wealthy and brought with them. They were among the wealthiest landowners in their area. So I think it was novelty. I think it was boredom on their part, the girls. I think it was maybe the realization that, especially for Adelaide, the charismatic, flirtatious sister who fell in love with the charming brother, I think it was the idea that maybe she could have a different kind of life than she had ever imagined. And then it was a question of convincing the shy brother and the plain kind of shy sister, the two socially awkward ones, to marry each other. And I just found that a really interesting premise.
The character of Sarah, as you alluded to earlier, a lot of grief in her life. And I'm curious about sort of what the takeaway might be, besides being an engaging read, for this situation and what Sarah went through. What are you hoping the readers will take from that?
I think Sarah's path through the novel is a really interesting one, as it was in her real life, as I discovered as I researched this woman. I think I would like to believe, and this is the trajectory that I show in the book, that she came to have quite a soulful relationship with Grace, the enslaved woman she was raised with, as I said. They really did end up living together until Sarah's death, along with two of Grace's sons. And also, Sarah, in real life, chose to be buried separately from her husband and her sister. And there was something in that that intrigued me. I wanted to understand why that happened. And so that was sort of the animating question of the book, I think. Why would this person choose to separate herself? You know, in real life, the descendants of Chang and Eng have many theories about it. And some of them are much sort of simpler than mine, meaning it just happened. She wanted to stay on her own property. And that's understandable. As a novelist, you're always looking for the story behind the story. And I really did come to believe that Sarah might be sending a message by doing that.
There's a question I like to ask authors of fiction, and it's this. If you could spend a day in real life with one of the characters in your novel, who would it be and why?
Well, in my case, like Sarah, it would have to be Eng, which of course means it would be Chang as well. I mean, the more I learned about these men, the more I understood how complex they were. These men had essentially been indentured, or some, as some people said at the time, sold into slavery by their mother. They wrested their own freedom away from the people who exploited them. And then they became slave owners themselves. What a crazy and complicated journey. They are the only people known to have been exploited by P.T. Barnum, who ended up making a fortune on their own from their own bodies, essentially, and then making a fortune on top of that. They lost that money and then they gained it back. They earned it back. So these guys were scrappy. They were brilliant. They, as I said, educated themselves. They were incredibly cultured. And they just did what it took to survive in a world that really didn't want them to. I think for many, many reasons, it would have been fascinating to have a conversation with Eng and Chang Bunker.
Yeah, I understand that they had really mixed feelings about going on tour because they did not like P.T. Barnum. But as you said, they did what was necessary. And when they needed to provide for themselves and their families, they were willing to use their unique bodily situation to make that happen.
That's right. They, as I said, did what it took. When they were being exploited originally by the British merchant and the managers that he hired, they were treated as exotic. They were displayed in pantaloons and these silks, colorful silks. They had long braids. When they wrested their own freedom away, they became quite westernized. They cut their hair short. They wore tuxedos. And instead of being exhibited in like town halls in these kind of tawdry settings, they would hire out rooms at the Ritz and have cocktail parties with snifters of brandy and crystal decanters. And they would hand out cigars and have civilized conversations with people in English. So they very much sort of on their own terms decided to display themselves. And not only that, they were among the first people that I've ever heard of in the early 19th century who put their name, they marketed their licenses. They licensed their likenesses for everything from cigar cases to figurines. So they were making money in all kinds of different ways. And they just figured out how to do that without losing their self-respect. And I thought that was fascinating.
What's next for you?
Gosh, I am in the middle of figuring that out, but I hope to have a book out within the next few years. I have a thriller coming out in March, the second of two, that I've co-written with my dear friend, a fellow writer, Ann Burt. And this one is called Watch Her Lie. It takes on the tradwife industry. And then my next novel that involves lots of research and is set in the past, I'm sort of wrestling with a few ideas.
Well, we'll look forward to seeing what you come up with next. This current work of historical fiction is The Foursome by Christina Baker Klein. Christina, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen to the latest episodes on your phone or tablet, and you'll also find us on Facebook. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.